On today's episode of The Good Word, Dan Werke of the LA Times joins us to discuss everything with the LA Lakers, including Bronny James, this very fun MVP discussion that does not have a tinge of weirdness to it, and who's more likely to make the finals between the Cavs and the Thunder. All that and much more on today's show. Welcome to The Good Word. My name is Vincent Goodwill, senior NBA reporter for Yahoo Sports. A bit of business before we get into today's show. We are on YouTube, so don't forget to rate, review, subscribe to us there. We are also on wherever you consume your audio podcast, so rate, review, subscribe to us there. Today's guest, I just ran into him in Boston, where we did our best to evade all of the Boston folks. My man Dan Werke of the LA Times. Dan, how you doing, man?
I did evade most of the people in Boston. I had nobody discussed any of the Wahlbergs with me while I was there. I was able to, I did have a conversation with somebody about The Town and a terrific movie that I enjoyed, but that they tried to argue with me that Blake Lively in The Town is attractive. And I said, like, she's like on meth that whole movie. Anyway, sorry.
Are we talking about? No. I'm doing a Google.
Seen The Town?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry, I have not seen The Town. I'm not Joe Mazzulla. I don't watch The Town like five times a day or anything like that.
Were they trying to rob Fenway Park? There, I will say, like, that movie has. I do end up stereotyping when I'm in Boston. Like, I do look around and it's like there's two type of people in Boston. There's the type of people who would try to rob Fenway Park and the type of people who wouldn't. It's basically like,
yeah, that's look. There's a bunch of conversations that we could have about Boston, Daniel, and we're not going to have them here because Boston tends to get a bit on the sensitive side. And I might have to spend I might have to spend most of early June in Boston, so I'm going to be quiet.
Safe bet.
Dan, we were in Boston for the Lakers-Celtics game. And for those who are unaware, it was the most anticipated game on the NBA calendar, bar none, and anticipated for the actual basketball. Like, Luka going back to Dallas is going to be anticipated because it's going to be a weird game on a bunch of different levels. But as far as the basketball, as far as the pageantry, as far as, you know, potential for a Lakers-Celtics finals, that game was the game. And for a half, it looked like, oh boy, the Lakers look up to snuff. Like, it looked, even though the Lakers hit this nine-game winning streak, I think it was nine. They hit this nine-game winning streak. Eight. This would have been nine. It looked like people were looking at this game like, oh, we'll see if they're legit, even though the Lakers have beaten some winning teams during that eight-game winning streak. But LeBron hurting his groin, and you were the first person that pointed it out. Like, I was like, oh, wait, I didn't even see him grab his groin, for a number of different reasons. I'm not looking for somebody to grab their groin. but Dan, all of this relies on a 40-year-old staying healthy. Like, this whole thing relies on LeBron, not just staying healthy, but looking great while doing it. Was that like a splash of cold water for all the positives that have happened since the Luka trade?
Yeah, I mean, I think, right, like, so, first of all, this matters on every team, right? Like, if one of your two best players gets hurt on any contender, huge red flag, big issue. And I think with LeBron, you know, yeah, we can talk about the age part of it, because that is a huge part of this, right? It is, like, this has been the challenge the Lakers have faced the last few seasons, which is how do you thread the needle between competing now while not investing too much in a future that's held together by 40-year-old joints and tendons with, like, crazy high mileage on them. And, you know, they thread that needle perfectly in the Doncic trade. I mean, just a manna from heaven, to borrow a Palenka phrase, really, from the Dallas Mavericks. But I think, Vinny, can I give you a stat?
Sure.
That I think sort of explains how good LeBron James has been and how good the Lakers have been. Since this is, I believe, since early December, they got blown out in back-to-back games against Minnesota and Miami. And prior to the Miami game, J.J. Redick had a meeting with LeBron James basically saying, you need to be better. You're not playing good. You're not playing well enough. This is like, we need more from you. You know, more talk on defense, all of this stuff. This then, you know, obviously he had the foot injury and goes away for a week and he comes back. But I'm going to run it. I ran stats today from that Miami loss, from the game after that Miami loss. The Lakers have played 40 games since then because of, you know, they lost two because of the fires. They are second in the NBA in defensive rating over those 40 games. They are 28-12. And this is like, you know, I think this idea that they've had just like a couple good winning streaks here is, it's not true. Like, they've been really, really good now for half the season. And they've been good without LeBron James for a stretch. They've been good without Anthony Davis for a lot of these games. They've been good when they've had Luka Doncic. They've been good when they haven't had Luka Doncic. They've just been good. And I think, you know, to me, the biggest sort of through line in all of this has been LeBron James playing like all NBA first team level basketball.
Mm.
Really since that moment. Two-way player. He's become like, I mean, he was, you know, the anchor really of this defense in terms of his smarts, closing out hard, you know, really, really good in isolation defense. And his effort and energy level over the last 40 games has been insane. Now, I'm not saying that that's wear and tear that has led to him injuring this groin. I look, it seems like he's not too worried about it. Mm-hmm. It'll be a week or two, maybe a little bit longer, but it's not like anybody's really that concerned that we're not going to see him again this regular season. Like, he'll be back, it seems like. But he has been, Vinny, he's been awesome. It's really as good as he's played in the regular season, in my opinion, since their title season, since 1920.
It's funny you brought up like the 40-game sample size. That is a big enough sample size for us to look at and say this is a sustainable mode of performance. And you're going 28-12, you extrapolate that, that's pretty much 55, 56 to almost 60 win pace, given the variance in schedule and everything else. Now, the question I was going to ask you, it's funny that you brought up defensively where they are, because I was going to go there. J.J. Redick, there's been a lot of, before J.J. Redick was hired, there was all of the talk about, wait, LeBron, you're doing a podcast with someone who, you know, you're doing a podcast with someone who's going to be an NBA coach, and you already have your coach, and blah, 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 and everything else, and it looks sort of bad. The optics of it looked bad. But you remove that. How much of this is J.J. Redick actually being more than just a viable head coach, but like a top five head coach? And how much of this, like you said, is this team just really plays hard, especially on the defensive end, because they don't have the size and everything else. And even when they did have the size, they were pretty damn good.
Yeah, I mean, I think before we like put J.J. Redick in that elite coaching territory, like, we have to see him in the postseason. Yeah. That's just really when, you know, the decisions and the adjustments and stuff like that, that part of coaching really crystallizes. I do think, judging coaching generally, Vinny, is pretty hard. You know what I mean? So much of it is, dependent on your roster. So much of it is dependent on stuff. And I think that's actually where Redick has really excelled, right? Like, he's a guy. I think I was talking to Jason Gallagher, who was part of that podcast company, The Old Man and the Three and stuff like that. And one of the things he told me about JJ and about working with JJ is that, obviously, like, you look at JJ Redick, Duke, white guy, pomaded hair, like, I mean, pretty arrogant, right, in that way. He's tremendously open-minded. And, like, usually arrogant people aren't that open-minded, right? And I think it does give him this really unique perspective where he has a lot of belief in what he's selling, but he also has sort of the awareness to pivot should he need to pivot, right? And over the course of this season, like, you know, this is a guy who, when he was hired, said, like, we're going to use math, right? And people kind of rolled their eyes around the NBA, like, okay, guy, like, we all have calculators. And he's become the guy that says, like, the cheat code to the NBA is just playing harder. Right. Which is like not analytics in any real fashion. Like, it's very much like just go bust your ass. And I think his ability to kind of straddle multiple worlds, his ability to like to take what he believes and mold it and adapt it to his roster, and then to clearly communicate that vision has been very good. And I think when I talk to people around the team, I talk to players in the locker room, communication comes up a lot. Like he is a constant like touch base, touch point, like where are you at? How are you feeling? Type of coach. Like he's and he's a truth teller. Like he tells us basically what he tells the team and vice versa. Like you can see that the Lakers post these clips post game of his speeches, and they basically mirror what he's saying post game to us. He's very direct in that way. And I think, right, like that's a thing we know about NBA players, whether they'll admit it or not, like they prefer to kind of know what's going on. And you know, and they would rather a tougher truth than, you know, a BS version of what's happening. And I think he's done a good job with credibility in that locker room. And then the other kind of strange thing, you mentioned the podcast, and like, I think, and I wrote this in the summer, the podcast relationship is like pretty overblown. Like these weren't guys that like had a real relationship of any of, you know, LeBron and JJ were not like golfing buddies prior to this, right? Like, you know, like that's just not, they were not in the same NBA circle. They did this thing. There was mutual respect, obviously, for Basketball IQ. It was a good business opportunity. They took it, you know, great, cool. I think the, but he did have a baseline relationship there. If you look at their roster, there are players that JJ Redick played with up and down this team, players that he had real relationships with prior. He was with Jackson Hayes in New Orleans. He was on that team. He played in Dallas with Luka Doncic. He played in Dallas with Markieff Morris. He played in Dallas with Dorian Finney-Smith and Maxi Kleber. He had Austin Reeves on his podcast. You know, like that's six guys right away. Oh, he played with Shake Milton in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Seven guys on the Lakers roster off the top of my head that he knew as a player. You know, sorry, Reeves he didn't, but like six. Like he had six former teammates on this team.
He had relationships. Seven guys he has relationships with.
Yeah, like a real head start. And I think you combine that with sort of the head start you get whenever you change a coach and the sort of built-in credibility that you get that way from being a fresh voice and stuff like that. And he's had a really good season.
No, I think, like you said, the arrogance is kind of off-putting, and then the TV personality that he had, you know, the plumbers and firemen conversation that he basically begun was not one of his better moments, and it extrapolated what people believed they already thought of him. You remove that, right? Remove that, and then you just said that he's, from a standpoint of going in and touching the guys, that's not what an arrogant coach does. The arrogant coach kind of sits on the ivory tower, and you have to come to him. He's very pious and all that type of stuff. He seems like he is, pardon me if I'm reaching, he seemed like, Dan, he is taking from his experience as a player where he didn't play a lot for his first few years, and he didn't play a lot his last few years, but those years in between where he was a pretty reliable scorer, he was an NBA level starter, like he ran every gamut except for being a superstar. And I think
he did that at Duke, Vinny.
Right.
And like he was a massive superstar in college.
Yes.
Right? Like in a way that he might have been one of
the last greatest college super. He might have been one of the last great college superstars.
Yeah. No, you're not reaching. You're onto something here. And I've said this before. I mean, he's lived every basketball life. And like to point to like some of the arrogant stuff, right? Like and how this shows up. Like, so when he first got the job, he would obviously get a lot of questions about being a first-time head coach. You've never done this before, blah, 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 blah. Like, basically, like, what gives you the right that makes you think you can do this? And he would scoff at the notion that he was inexperienced. And I think, you know, if you view it through his eyes, he's tremendously experienced. He's lived every life you could possibly live as a basketball player, like, from that huge star in college in a way that, like, very few people are the main character that kind of way to being a disappointment or couldn't get on the court in Orlando to like finally like breaking in to being traded in the middle of the season, having to adjust to that, to like becoming a starter and, you know, being a reliable player to then eventually becoming sort of like that vet who doesn't really have much to offer other than his voice as his body injury. It's like, he's sort of lived every role.
It's funny, now that I think about that, I wonder if that's where the Markieff Morris throw line comes in, where you're getting Luka Doncic in the trade, of course, and you want Luka to come to you. Hey, you want Luka Doncic? It's like, hey, do you want to go on a date with Halle Berry? Why, yes, I would. It doesn't matter that I'm married. Of course I'll go on a date with Halle Berry, like that sort of thing.
Sure.
But you just wrote a story about Markieff being one of the last vets that can have uncomfortable conversations with LeBron James. I laughed because I just thought of someone's title of their podcast being Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man. I'm sure you know exactly who I'm talking about, Dan. But the fact that LeBron has these conversations with both, you know, J.J. Redick as his head coach, and you said, you know, J.J. demanded more, and then Markieff Morris coming in and being not just enforcer, but being guy who can tell LeBron, hey, we need more out of you, or hey, what, insert statement X. I think that is like critically important as LeBron gets more and more disconnected from the NBA world, because the NBA LeBron came up in and the NBA that we know right now are two totally different leagues.
Totally. Yeah. You know, going into the trade deadline, I was having a lot of conversations with people around, you know, the league and around the locker room and the Lakers front office. And, you know, one of the things that I would say advocating is probably the word, like behind the scenes, was sort of like, you know, if you look at the good Laker teams of the LeBron era, right, there's been two that have had deep playoff runs. You know, both were with first time head coaches, Frank Vogel, first year with the Lakers head coaches, Frank Vogel, Darvin Ham. The Frank Vogel team had Jared Dudley on the bench. You know, a LeBron James confidant, certainly somebody who LeBron was comfortable communicating with, you know, and could kind of have, you know, a different level of conversation than you can have with, say, you know, a younger guard, right? Or somebody like that. Like, it's just different. And then the second team had Tristan Thompson. And they signed him very late in the regular season. Tristan Thompson is playing this role right now for the Cleveland Cavaliers. Yes, if you talk to people around that team, you know, invaluable. You know, what they like what they say. You could see it last night, by the way. He scored late in that game against Milwaukee, and you could see the way the bench reacted to Tristan Thompson getting a bucket. And it's just like, you know, this type, I'm a big believer in that everything sort of matters. Like, it's so hard to win games. It's so hard to win a championship that, like, anything you could do that, like, gives you a decimal point percent chance better, like, you should try and do it.
Yeah. Yep.
and I think having, like, these kinds of players in your system, on your bench, you know, specifically with the Lakers, right? Like, if you're going to, like, tell LeBron that you need him to get back more on defense, right? Mm-hmm. You can argue about that and you might be right, but at a certain point in time, like, you know, that conversation can boil down to, like, I'm LeBron James and you're not. And like, believe me, that conversation would end that same way with Markieff Morris, but like, he's won a championship with Markieff Morris. Mm-hmm. Like, they were teammates together. You know, at that level, you know, in a time, by the way, when that team was totally isolated too in the bubble, like, that's valuable. Like, that relationship is valuable. And it's different hearing it from Markieff Morris than it is hearing it from Austin Reeves or hearing it from Jackson Hayes or even Anthony Davis. You know what I mean? I think having it be eyes that are impartial, that are not involved, you know, from somebody who has a voice and a toughness that you respect, like, I think, like, you know, that's an ingredient to a championship team. Now, none of this is to say the Lakers will win or won't win because of Markieff Morris. Like, it's not necessarily that. But what I think is that everything matters, and that having a guy who can credibly speak to your star and who can take some of the leadership off of his plate, by the way, too. Like, your best player and your vet shouldn't be the same guy.
Right.
Those are two really important jobs. Those are two really important jobs. And, you know, LeBron can't spend his time, like, worrying about, like, where Dalton Connect's head is at after the Charlotte trade. You know what I mean? Like, he's got a bigger fish to fry. Like, he's got to be their, you know, their best two-way player. Like, he's got other stuff he's got to do. Having Markieff Morris, like, go to Dalton Connect and say, like, basically, like, F the trade. Who cares? Do you. That's all that matters. Which was a conversation that happened the first time they met. You know what I mean? Like, that's the type of stuff that matters. And if you can get that in a trade where you also pick off Luka Doncic, you know what I mean? It is like all the pieces matter, right, Vinny? And that's to me, I think is a sneaky important thing. Not to mention the fact in that story as well, I report, like, there's some optimism that Maxi Kleber is going to be available at some point this season. We'll see, right? There's still some weeks to go, in terms of his recovery from foot surgery. But, like, it's not completely out of the question that he's back before the regular season ends. And that's another player, too, who does things that the Lakers want and need, and is sort of an interesting piece that's sort of lurking out there in this trade. For a team that gets killed around the league, Vinny, for losing on the margins a lot, like, I'm sure you've had that conversation about the Lakers before. This team has done pretty good on the margins.
No, I feel like that's one of the underrated things that the Lakers have done well. It has been like maximizing the draft picks. Like, maybe you don't get like a Jalen Hood-Safino type of thing. Maybe that doesn't work out. But when you look at the way that they've historically drafted, and not at the top of the draft because they haven't really been at the top of the draft, they've done well. And I just think we are not inclined to give the Lakers credit because they have so many advantages that other teams do not, that you're going to pick apart some of the other things. Now, you talked about LeBron being their best two-way player. Go read the story about Markieff Morris that he just posted for the LA Times about Markieff Morris being one of the last vets around the league. You brought up the Luka conversation, so let's have it a little bit before we go to break. Luka is not yet playing like MVP Luka Doncic, right? Like, at least from an efficiency standpoint and everything else. But he's still capable. Like, I was looking up, I was talking to some friends the other day, and I was like, or yesterday, because it's Monday, it was yesterday. I was looking up and I was like, he was getting locked up by Jaylen Brown. And then I go and look at his numbers. He had 34 and 8. Like, what are we doing here? Like, he's still that very good. Like, where is he, do you think, as far as him acclimating himself to this team, acclimating himself to playing with LeBron and getting himself in shape?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a slow but steady process. I think people should not discount the emotional whiplash that the trade hit him with. That, you know, this is, you know, obviously you watch him on the court, like, he's an incredibly emotional player. Mm-hmm. And he had intended to play his whole career in Dallas. Like, that was the plan, right? Was to follow in Dirk's footsteps in that way. That's what he wanted for himself. He was comfortable within the organization. Sure, there were problems, but that's where he wanted to be, right? And then to be sort of woken up with the news that, hey, by the way, you're not on the Mavericks anymore, and him not knowing that that was even a possibility, really.
Right.
It shook him. Like, it really, I mean, like, it shook him. You could see it in his face. Could hear it in his voice in those first kind of early weeks with the Lakers that this was not an easy thing for him to handle emotionally. Now, I think he has adjusted and he has started to adjust, and but it's a slow process, right? And then you add in the basketball part of it, which is, you know, you're playing with LeBron James, who does a lot of the stuff that you do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you, like, in terms of ball dominance, in terms of like orchestrating an offense. You want to do it. You want to do right by LeBron because that's a player you grew up, you know, idolizing. But at the same time, you know, a deferring Luka Doncic, like, sort of, what's the point? And I think there's been some ironing out of that, and it's gotten better. It's seemingly like, you know, that is settled. Like, this is Luka's offense to run. This isn't going to be a your turn, my turn thing. Guys are going to have to learn how to play off of Luka Doncic, and he's going to have to learn, you know, how to best utilize LeBron James and how to best utilize Austin Reeves and stuff like that. I think, like, you know, that's still very much in progress, but they're winning and they've been winning. You know, even, you know, you mentioned the Boston game, like, the Lakers made some shots early in that game. I do not think they played very well in that game, generally speaking. And you look at that box score again, like, defensively, how, you know, Boston scores, I think, 111 points. Like, I think Tatum and Brown have to play like 86 minutes and take 50 shots or something like that combined. Like, really, you know, kept them off the 3-point line after a really hot start from there. Made some really solid defensive adjustments in game and gave themselves a chance. Like, they were, you know, I mentioned Reeves, mentioned Connect earlier. Both of those guys had big threes in the fourth quarter that didn't fall. And they played the last 7 minutes without LeBron James. You know, I think, like, this team is in a pretty good spot with, like, a pretty high upside still, because
yes.
Like, they're not there offensively. Like, they're still really trying to figure this out offensively. And I think there is a world in which you can envision the Lakers getting two or three defenders on the ball with Luka Doncic and then going 4-on-3 or 4-on-2 with LeBron James or Austin Reeves attacking, you know, disadvantaged defenses. And that's like, oh my God, right? Like, how do you stop that?
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's unfortunate that we're going, put it like this. I don't think it's unfortunate. I think it's unfortunate for defenses that LeBron could very well be the guy that attacks closeouts, as opposed to the guy, LeBron being the guy who initiates the closeout and starts the inertia. Right, that's probably the best way to put it. Mm-hmm. LeBron has never been the guy to benefit off of inertia. Not really. Now he's going to be the guy who has, by and large, mastered the game as the guy who's now going to benefit off of someone else's gravity. That is going to be very scary.
We saw it once. I think we saw it once. Vinny, really quickly. I think we saw it once. We saw him do it one time. Paris. This summer. And I think, like obviously this team isn't as talented as that. But I think, like, sort of Olympics LeBron as an off-the-ball driver of stuff, as a guy who can create energy in transition and in the half court make all the smart plays, is like the perfect version of him at this stage in his career. And like, somehow the league has gifted him a conductor and Luka Doncic to totally unlock it. And I don't think they're all the way there yet, but I think it's possible.
Thanks, Nico. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Good Word, here with Dan Werke of the LA Times. Dan, Thursday night, LeBron James and Markieff Morris walked up to Stephen A. Smith, walked out of the huddle before the start of the fourth quarter. I think while somebody was taking like one of those $10,000 shots from half court, he walked up to Stephen A. Smith and it was caught on social media, and Stephen A. had this thing about it and everything else. Keep my son's name out your mouth, pretty much, blah, blah, blah. How do you view that? Like, that just seems very weird that LeBron James, who has conducted himself the way he's conducted himself, now turned into that. Like, there's multiple ways you can view this. You can view this through the lens of, LeBron, are you stepping over the line? Your son is an NBA player, blah, blah, blah. Or LeBron is a dad. He's going to try to protect his son, no matter what way you view LeBron's machinations to get Bronny on this team. I have a feeling, because you've been around Bronny in an NBA locker room, that you view this through the lens of Bronny James.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, like, you know, you mentioned, like, first of all, like, none of this is normal, right? Like, on any front. It is not, generally speaking, normal for an NBA player to break a huddle and walk to the scorer's table and walk past a journalist or a commentator, right? Like, generally speaking, that is not where people sit. But Stephen A, being, you know, who Stephen A is not sitting on press row. He's sitting courtside with Larry David and Ari Emanuel, and he's sitting courtside directly between the Lakers bench and the scorer's table. So, like, there is, like, an element of, like, sort of, like, he's right there. Like, he sat there a couple times this season. Okay. So, the opportunity was there, I suppose, right? And certainly LeBron, smart enough to know that people are going to see it. There's a level of performance in all of this, in addition to probably being sincerely pissed. I just think of this, like, I've dealt with this all season. It is just really hard to have normal conversations about Bronny James. It's been normal since the combine. It's been hard since the combine, when people started talking about evaluating him as a prospect, and you would hear things like, hostage theories, basically, where like, would a team draft him even as early as like late in the first round, and a draft that teams didn't feel was very good because of the notion that the Lakers will then eventually have to come get him and give up picks and better drafts. Like, these were conversations that were happening around the league within front offices. Now, I don't think they were very long conversations, but they were happening. Like, what is the value in having this guy to trade him then later to a Lakers team or whatever team LeBron James is on that wants to sort of save him? Like, is that a better use of our pick than, say, on, you know, a two-way player or somebody we're going to have to stash in our G League for a couple years? Okay, so there's that part of it, right? It's been impossible since day one to evaluate him fully as an NBA player because – and when you try to do it, you look at his number, because part of the value in drafting Bronny James, by the way, is that you're betting on the fact that he's LeBron James's kid and you're betting on his athleticism. You're betting on, you know, the type of basketball he's been exposed to, for his entire life. And that's unlockable to a degree. Like, so it is really hard to separate it. Plus, Vinny, there's the fact that not dissimilar to like Thanasis Antetokounmpo, like if you have this player and it makes your best player, we talked earlier in the first one, percentage points happier, and it makes him percentage points more engaged. Like one of the things LeBron has said about playing hard every night this year is his son is there. He wants to show him how to be a pro night in, night out. Like, worth it. 100% worth it. Like, they should draft Zuri James if that's going to be the case. Like, that matters too. I do think like what's happened this season is, you know, and it's unfair to me, I think, to like, look, nobody thought Bronny James was going to like matter in the NBA this year.
Right.
Like even people who are like in on the player, like that this was always a developmental project. It has gone really well in the G League this season for Bronny James. He's played very good basketball down there. He's taken pretty big steps as a point guard, which is like, you know, or it's like a primary ball handler, which, you know, starting the summer was going to be a real problem. I mean, G League stats are really hard to put together. I'm going to pull this here right here. This is like his 8 regular season games or whatever. There's a tip-off tournament too. That's the first half of the year. You know, 34 minutes a game, 44.5% from the field, 39% from 3 on 8 attempts, high volume. You know, he's up to 5 rebounds, 5 assists, 3 turnovers, a little too high, 2 steals per game, 21 points. Okay. For a player that you've taken at the end of the second round, who has obvious limitations, he'll always be 6'1", right? Like, I think he's learning how to play at an NBA pace with an NBA motor, getting in that kind of shape, certainly getting confidence after a pretty miserable first year in college, which started, by the way, with a near-death experience.
Right.
I think all of that is totally fair to say when you discuss Bronny James. But the but here is, though, if you do talk about him as sort of how he has performed when he's gotten opportunities in the NBA, and really he's had 2 all season. He played in the opener, which was sort of an orchestrated moment. Not sort of. It was an orchestrated moment. And then he played in Philadelphia. And that was not orchestrated. That was, he had been playing well in the G League, and this is what you do when you need players and you've got a guy who's playing well, you want to give him an opportunity and see how he does. And he did not do well. Like, Tyrese Maxey cooked him. His confidence was very low. The game looked way too fast for him. And it was not a good game and in a bad spot. And I believe it was a national TV game too.
It was a TNT game.
And after the game, JJ Redick owned it, said this was a bad idea. you know, or maybe we put him in a bad spot. And I think they did put him in a bad spot in that game. But quite frankly, I mean, this is like, we are talking about a player that is still, you know, a season or so away, who's still trying to figure out what kind of player he's going to be in the NBA. And it is really hard to have these kind of nuanced conversations about him because he's incredibly famous. We go into these arenas. As soon as the Lakers go up 10 points in the fourth quarter, you hear, we want Bronny Chance. It's not normal. And it's not normal for LeBron James to be able to separate the fact that it's his teammate or a second-round pick or some other NBA player, because it's not. It's his son. And, you know, he's got to be sensitive to conversations right. about Bronny James. He has been sensitive to conversations about Bronny James since I saw LeBron at Summer League this year ahead of the Olympics, right? Or I'm sorry, Team USA. And he was still talking about people like Bronny had had a decent game that day in it was either Summer League or the Cal Classic or something like that. He had played well, and LeBron was like at the, even that day was like talking about people who were saying bad things about Bronny James as a player. It's just like, I don't know, as a dad, you know, when I go into parent teacher conferences and people talk to me about my son or his attention level, like where he's at as a reader or different things like that, I take it all personally. I know I shouldn't, or maybe in my case, I probably should. It's probably a reflection of me. But like, you know, I think like when he has a bad game in T-ball, it's like, I don't want to hear that. Like, I'm as like, and it's just this being on that type of stage, I think underscores how weird the situation is generally.
No,
did I carry enough water for everybody involved? Did I carry enough water for everybody involved there?
Are your shoulders tired? I'm just curious. Are your shoulders a little, a little sore? Are your shoulders a little sore there? Way to, you deftly walk the line. No, I think being honest here, I'm not a parent. So I can't speak to what it's like to be LeBron James in this spot. Like you're a parent, as you just mentioned. The weird thing is, from a sober, just journalistic standpoint with no emotion involved, it's very easy to criticize LeBron and say, is that your son or is he a basketball player? A professional basketball player? Like, which one is it? Because if he's your son,
it's
then...
It's both. It's both.
Right. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Emotionally, I can extract the emotion from it and say, it's got to be one or the other. You know what I mean? But you can't extract the emotion from it. This is all emotion. Like, the conversation about Bronny James is all emotion. It's the nepotism. It's the black father, blah, blah, blah. All these different things.
Well, and it's LeBron saying things about Bronny, like being good enough to be in the league last
that
year
is
and
where,
stuff like that.
Where the conversation got weird. That is where the conversation got really unfortunate, and LeBron has to own
that. It's not weird, though. But it's not weird. Here's why I can tell you it's not weird, and this isn't exactly the same. One of my mentors in this business, Bruce Feldman, terrific college football reporter.
Yes.
Good friend of mine for years. I have two children. I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. My oldest, when he was like 2, was like a very like loved baseball and was like very comfortable with a bat in his hand, hitting a ball and stuff like that. And I remember showing Bruce a video of Cam hitting a baseball and being like, look at this. Like, I mean, like, this is crazy for a 2-year-old to be there. And he's like, okay, Dan, like, calm down. Like, every dad does this with their kid. Like, and I watched it and I was like, oh man, like, he could be on the White Sox now. He might. The White Sox are awful. But there was video, like, an element of this where you, like, see him and you see the best, right? You see mm-hmm. the best. You also see the very worst. But, like, you when you show other people, like, I'm itching to show you a video of him hitting a double in his last T-ball game right now. Granted, he ran to right field after the single. He took a pretty wide turn. But I'm still very proud. And so, like, I actually don't think this is, like, that abnormal, other than the fact that it's all happening in an NBA locker room instead of, like, a cigar bar or a backyard around a grill or something like that.
It's weird.
Like, he's not the first father to say this about their kids.
Right. Yes. It's weird because we're seeing it. It's weird because LeBron went out and tweeted. That's the only thing. LeBron went out and tweeted last year, you know, Bronny is better than most of these guys or a lot of guys playing in the league. And that basically poked everybody's antennas up or whatever. The weird thing is, if I'm Bronny James, and this has nothing to do with any of the confrontation, the last place I want to be at 19 years old is being around my daddy every day. I spent my whole life trying to get away from my parents. And you know what? You know what's real fun when you're getting away from your parents, Dan? College. You can have a lot of fun in college. And like right now, regardless of what it is, G League, Lakers bench, or whatever, it does not look like Bronny James is having a lot of fun. And like you said with LeBron,
I disagree.
With Stephen
I disagree.
You think this is fun?
I think that this has gone about as good as it could have gone, and probably okay. even maybe slightly better. I think there have, like, in terms of internal distraction, it hasn't occurred. Like Bronny is, like, really, really well liked within the locker room. He's really well liked by the media. He's really well liked by his teammates, by his coaches. He's a really good worker, great kid. People like being around him. He's funny. He's like very much like seen but not heard, like as a rookie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, does the right stuff in that way, right? Like, does not.
I have heard good things about him. Yeah. As,
so there's that, you know, there's been like that part way. Of it.
Yeah.
You know, think about like, okay, like the part of this too, right? As you mentioned, like if you're 19 years old and you don't want to be around your dad, like that, like in normal circumstances, again, I would agree. His father for his entire life has spent months of the year not around. You know, basketball season runs parallel with Bronny's basketball seasons, right? Like, generally speaking, I was going to write this that night. Turns out something else happened. When the Lakers won at Madison Square Garden, Bronny scores in Madison Square Garden, at the end of that blowout game. Pretty neat moment, right? Father and son right. scoring in the same game in the Garden. Do you know how many times Bronny James had been to Madison Square Garden before that game?
Is that his first time?
First time ever. Okay. And you're like, how is that even possible? Right?
How
like
would the he, Cavs, how, the how else would he beat it? How why else would he beat it?
He was playing he was playing basketball. Like, he was doing stuff, right. You know, while his dad was doing this stuff, right? While his dad has been going everywhere. And now they're getting to experience basketball together. And I think that's pretty special, as convoluted and contrived as it can be at certain times. You know, you see Bronny, the look on Bronny's face when like LeBron like has like a poster dunk or something like that on the bench, like celebrating those plays, celebrating his teammates' plays. You watch the Laker players celebrate when Bronny does something well. You know, it's like I said, I think like this could have been like a disaster in a lot of ways, in terms of like a lot of hurt feelings in the locker room, things about like nepotism and favoritism and different stuff like that. It hasn't. Been that at all, being there. Like, I think Bronny's played well in the G League. He's shown an indication, you know, that he's willing to work. He does not carry himself. You know, he doesn't violate one of the big NBA like locker room unwritten rules, which is like know your place. Like, he does not violate like that rule like ever in that locker room, as far as anything that I've seen or heard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there have been far less famous rookies in this league that have broken that rule. You know that's what I mean? Who've wanted more for themselves than what's out there. So I think it's hard to have this conversation because like there is like a lot of like people put their feelings onto this a lot. Mm-hmm. Also because like we've never seen it before, and I think as people we don't process things we can't compare to other events very well. But like I said, being around it every day, I think it's been, you know, it's gone pretty well. And it's crazy, Vinny, as far as like the Stephen A thing, like sort of like rebrought it to the surface. It's not been a thing like we've spent a lot of time talking about this year, because like, quite frankly, the season has been so crazy.
Yep.
And so many other wild things have happened. Like, you know, like that night at Madison Square Garden, like LeBron said, you know, playing with Bronny is the thing he's been most proud of in his entire career. Right. Like, big story that night. For 7 minutes, and then they traded for Luka Doncic. You know what I mean? Like, Bronny James is a pretty big story until, like, wildfires wipe out, you know, a chunk of the city, including the head coach's house.
Right.
Like, at the start of the season, it seemed like this was all just going to be a part to placate LeBron James at the end of a career as the Lakers headed back towards the play-in tournament. And, oh, look, like, you know, they're second or third place in the West. Like, it's just, like, it's kind of faded mostly to the background. Actually, like on a day-to-day thing, being around them, because they've handled it pretty well.
This has been one of the weirder NBA seasons. Like you said, we all thought that the Lakers were a completely unserious organization because of the way that the Bronny stuff was handled and, like you said, manipulated and everything else. And then
sure.
The Luka Doncic things happens. And then you have like this sort of incredible wait a minute, this team is actually really good moment that they're in. Like, this is just all-time weird. This is just one of those all-time weird NBA seasons we're going to put in a capsule 10 years from now. I'm like, wait, all that happened in 1 year, and we're going to be talking about it at that point. When we come back, we're going to talk about the MVP discussion. I'm going to ask Dan something about what's most likely to happen in the playoffs. All right, it's time for the last word, or the last words, with Dan Werke of the LA Times. Dan, before we get into the super last word, we're going to start with the MVP conversation. Nikola Jokic is averaging the most points he's ever averaged in the NBA, right around 29. He's shooting 43% from three, which is a career high. He's averaging a triple-double, which we have said, not me, but we have said, hey, if you average a triple-double, you should get an MVP. Remember that dumb stuff that we said about Russell Westbrook 7 or 8 years ago, and we gave him an MVP because we felt bad for him, because we gave an MVP for him because of the number 10. I digress. But with Jokic, what he's doing, and a 30-20-20 game on Friday night, and then you have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who dropped 40 on Jokic's Denver Nuggets on national TV. How do we determine this MVP conversation? Because it felt like a month ago we decided that Jokic was not winning another MVP, at least not this year, and we decided that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was going to win an MVP this year. Are we sure?
We're not sure, and we shouldn't be sure. I don't know what to do. Luckily, like at Daily Times, we don't vote for these awards. It is like a company policy, and I'm glad that we don't. I wouldn't know as of today. On Friday, I was ready to vote for Nikola Jokic. Today, I am not as ready to vote for Nikola Jokic. I am very much compelled by both arguments. I do think my only thing on this is that I would encourage people, or at least I know the way that I would view it. I don't think we should hold the fact that Nikola Jokic has won three times against him. I kind of think we should actually use it for him as an argument, like in terms of ties, that his sustained greatness and stuff like that too should like also like it shouldn't be a detriment. The fact that this guy has been this great and is an all-time great, 15 years from now when we look back at seasons, like if Nikola Jokic plays his best season and doesn't win MVP, like that is sort of a weird sort of like postcard moment. Like it would be nice to have that as a way to sort of reconcile what we're seeing in terms of stats. Yeah. But like, I mean, Shai has been incredible. He's been as good and he's on a better team. It's really, really hard to kind of separate those two. It's a really fun, I generally don't like MVP debates. This is a really fun one. Because it's about basketball.
It's not toxic. That's the.
It's about basketball. It is about basketball. It is about. I mean, I just don't want it to devolve into like, what does valuable mean? Like, I don't like that part of it. That discussion, because like, dude, we've been doing that for like 85 years. Like, just like, right. It means what your heart wants it to mean. But like, it is trying to judge which one of these players has had the better season is fascinating.
I think it's funny. I think Bobby Marks from ESPN, I'm reading a tweet, and I'm sure Dakota's going to put it on the screen for YouTube. He says, I do not vote for league honors, but I have a question. What is the criteria for MVP? One, best player. Two, impacts his team the most. Three, team record. Four, a combination of all three. And there is no actual defined thing. It's a combination. It is about feel. It's about it's largely about feel, which means it's really hard for us to say exactly what it is, because you have 120 or I think 100 separate voters in ways that 100 separate people have their own individual criteria, and each year has its own criteria, like the story of each year. I'm not a quote-unquote narrative voter.
Less groupthink. This is great. Like, that's what I mean. Like, this is great. This is what it's about. This is why it's a diverse set of voters.
I think this is going to be less groupthink. This is going to be a year where I think the MVP is going to be really close. I don't think that this is going to be one of those years where if you don't vote for Nikola Jokic, you hate thing X. or if you don't vote for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you hate thing X. You're not voting against someone, you're voting for someone. And I think that is a critical element of this that we don't really discuss anymore, because 1 year, y'all, someone decided to bring race into the MVP discussion. And baby, let me tell you, that wasn't fun. Wasn't fun.
Can I veer us into a different direction briefly here on this?
I'm afraid.
It's like another basketball thing too. It is like he's not going to win MVP. He may not finish in the top five, weirdly, because of his stats. But Donovan Mitchell's season too, and like the way that he has said, I will do less. My usage will go down. I will defend more. I will enable people around me. I'll make others better too. He has had an incredible season. And it is like one of those types of things that, you know, it just feels weird to penalize him in terms of voting because his counting stats aren't the same as they've been in the past. When, again, that team is awesome and he's playing on both sides of the ball and that team is nowhere near as good without him. And it is just like it's just a real there's just so much good basketball happening this season. It is a really fun, robust basketball debate. It should be, at least. And I think, you know, there's interesting. One and two is fascinating. Three through six on a ballot is really, really fascinating.
It's only five.
No, but I mean, like, even like there's going to be a guy left off the ballot. Like, I could have made a pretty compelling LeBron James case to be on the ballot. The groin injury probably knocks him out of a lot of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think, like, you know, certainly Jason Tatum, like, plays both sides of the basketball on a really good freaking team. Like, you know, Giannis's numbers this season are insane again. And no, it is just like, it's good. There's so much good basketball.
This is one of those years where we're going to look at, once again, in a time capsule. And I think one of the best, there's some MVP years where you're like, man, this was going to be really close no matter what happens.
Mm-hmm.
There were some years that I've covered and I'm like, man, this is going to be really weird, right? The Joel Embiid Jokic year, very weird. This is not the weird year. This is the compelling year. The Russell Westbrook year, really weird because that was not about a bunch of things that it should have been about.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny you mentioned Jokic because I think of like Michael Jordan's greatest seasons. He didn't win MVP. Like 90, yeah, he didn't win MVP.
I don't like that about his legacy. Weird part of his legacy.
Well, that was a weird year because Charles Barkley received the most number one votes, but Magic Johnson won the award. Like, it's weird. In 93, he didn't win it. Charles Barkley won it. Like, it's a weird thing. And I'm one of those guys that goes deep into the crates of
you
history.
You love the MVP. You are like an MVP. I'm not a nerd.
I'm not one of the MVP geeks. I'm a historical nerd.
You're historical. You're as an MVP historian is incredible. People should know that about you. It's a tremendous parlor trick that you have.
Yeah, it is. We can if you ask me a year, I will guarantee you that post merger, I can tell you why I said player one MVP. Now, the very, very last word, because this is from producer Dakota, and he sent me this yesterday, and I thought this was really, 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 really good, right? What is most likely to happen, or more likely to happen, Dan, the Cavs make it to the NBA Finals or the Thunder do not?
Okay. This is a really good question, Dakota. I prefer something lazier than this next time. I think it is more likely that the Cavs make it to the NBA Finals. But it's close. Because I think there's a decent chance we see the Cavs and the Thunder in the NBA Finals. That feels like a pretty logical endpoint in a lot of ways. Now, the arguments against one is sort of the arguments against the other when it comes to, like, we haven't seen you do it before in the playoffs. But both teams have tremendous depth. They have size. I kind of like Cleveland. I mean, I definitely like Cleveland's offensive punch more than I like the Thunder's. I do think that they're just top to bottom shot making. I like it better. I think the Thunder sort of like defensive thrust is a little higher in terms of their physicality.
But
it's close. I mean, like when I've seen Cleveland play this year, like they've defended. Like they've really defended physically. They're huge in the front court. with Mobley. Both teams are really similar. Obviously, Shea is the difference maker between these two teams. But I do think, like, and I was talking to some agents about this before the Boston game last night. Like, you know, they were asking me, like, basically, like, if you had to bet your life on a team, like, who would it be at this point, and to make the finals. And, like, I was like, I don't want to have to make that bet, to be totally clear. After I said, that's a horrible thing to ask me to do. After that, I kind of landed on Cleveland as a team that I think I really believe in.
The weird thing for us with Cleveland is, like you said, it's the point of we've never seen them do it together, but they have the ingredients. It's almost like similar to light in a lighter way, similar to the conversation that we had about Boston, except Boston has made it to the NBA Finals. They've made it through the gauntlet of the Eastern Conference at least once, and they've made it to the doorstep all those years going into, like, you know, five of the last seven, you know, Eastern Conference Finals and all that type of stuff. Like they're there. The only reason I wouldn't say Cleveland is because I think Boston, if Boston is healthy and whole, Jesus, they are just good. Like, it's no other way to put it is that if they are completely healthy and completely concentrated, the question you have is health. Porzingis, Horford, Holiday. You've got three players in your rotation who are old or hurt, or old and hurt. That's a lot to ask about. That's a lot to ask for a top-ish heavy team.
They're 1-7, and their 1-7 is awesome, right? Yes. Like, their 1-7 is incredible.
And you win with 7 in the playoffs.
You win with 7 in the playoffs. Where, but, like, 7-8 and, like, 7-9 is where it really gets dicey for them in ways that it's not true for the Thunder, the Celtics, or I'm sorry, the Cavs. You know, a lot of teams really that are in this sort of like contender conversation, like that to me is like the big difference, right? Is that it is in those places, and like how much that matters in a playoff series is hard to say. I do think one thing, that this is completely anecdotal in the playoffs, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you feel like this, when like every year there's like one series that gets flipped by like an eighth man. Like last year was Nikhil Alexander Walker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that was, I believe, Phoenix, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah.
Like, where, you know, like a guy who just kind of has like a heater. You know what I mean? And like, I don't know I don't know who that would be on Boston.
It's going to be somebody.
I don't know if they need it though. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, they're so good 1-7. Like,
the margins are, here's the thing, they're so good. And we think of them in the way that we thought of the Celtics last year or the run through the playoffs last year. They were not challenged. They didn't have a single hard series at all, not even in the finals. This year is not going to be that. They're going to have a lot of landmines along the way. I don't know if there's going to be a single easy series for any team in the NBA this year. Like, you're going to have some series that aren't as compelling as others, but I think you're going to have competitive series across the board. Even if you know what the outcome is going to be, you can look at it and say, yeah, this is going to be a tough six. And that's where I think Cleveland is aided in a way. Because like you said, let's give Donovan Mitchell his credit here. At some point, he's going to say, enough of this, and I need to take this thing over. And he has the ability, even at 6-1¾, as a shooting guard, to take over a game and take over a series similar to a Shea Gilgeous-Alexander in that way. Maybe not at the same level of efficiency because Shea
They're
going
to win 60 games.
Yes. Yes. They're good. They're not the Atlanta Hawks of 2015 or whatever year that was. This is not that. You have two high-level players who can extend beyond their regular season performance in Donovan Mitchell and Evan Mobley, who I think is Tim Duncan. If Tim Duncan were skinnier and came up in a league where you told big men that you had to shoot threes. That's what I think about Evan Mobley in that way. And then with Oklahoma City, you're looking at, man, all they got is wings. And I don't say all they got is wings is a bad thing. They are like Oprah giving away cars. You got a wing. You got a wing. You got a wing. It's they Jalen Williams, Lou Dort, Shea. Like, they have
Aaron Wiggins.
Yes, you have more of that than any other team. And I firmly believe in this NBA, you used to win with bigs. I still think you, by and large, can win with bigs. But now you win with wings.
I think the bigs, too. Like, I mean, I think, like, Oklahoma City's bigs are fascinating.
You know what I mean? Like one of the things like I thought the knock on Oklahoma City last year and talking to teams about playing the Thunder, right, was this notion that you could push them around. Right. That like they weren't physically up to it. You know, that they were kids playing a grown man's game, and that eventually in the playoffs, like teams would, for lack of a better term, would just Oakley their way through them. Right? Like kind of like that's how you would beat the Thunder. Yeah. I don't think you can do that anymore.
No, you're not gonna push them around. And I think we look at them and say, oh, they're the baby Thunder. I don't know if they're the baby Thunder anymore in the way that we think of a team that has to have multiple heartbreaks. This league moves so freaking fast now. Like, your championship window is 2 years. So if your championship, in my opinion, championship windows are 2 years in the NBA. It moves too fast. You have to pay guys. You have to get guys out of there, second aprons, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You don't have room to get your heart broken twice. You got room to get your heart broken once, you dust yourself off, and you try again. Thanks, Aaliyah. Now, that is my man, Dan Wojcicki from the LA Times. Dan, I anticipate seeing you a lot over the next couple of months because I'm going to be in LA more.
And
I think LA is going to be, yes, very. Your black friend will be around a lot during the playoffs. I am here to educate you on how Detroit is so much better than Chicago. That's Dan Wojcicki, y'all. Yes, I said that. Thanks to Dakota London, my man, producer, and the entire team that works so hard behind the scenes on this show. I'll be taking a little bit of a break, but when I am back ready to go for the playoff stretch, the playoff run, all that stuff. Until then, everybody be safe.